Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Morgan Babst about her new novel, The Floating World. And we'll hear from David Fulmer about Eclipse Alley, the newest entry in his Storyville Set mystery series. Morgan Babst is a New Orleans native, born and raised. She went to the Academy of the Sacred Heart, studied writing at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, then went on to Yale, then to New York University for her MFA. She's published essays and short fiction in the Oxford American and Guernica, among other publications. And today we're celebrating her first novel, The Floating World. Morgan Babst, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, The Floating World is this lengthy, beautifully written novel about the way one family struggles in Katrina's aftermath. And it's a complicated family in the way that New Orleans families can be. So tell us a little bit about the Waterays and what they're facing in this post-Katrina world.
The Waterays left on the eve of the storm, leaving their daughter, Cora, at home. She refused to go. Cora is a particularly sensitive person, and I think she felt that leaving New Orleans was just not tenable for her. She had tried to go before to college, and it ended up taking a bus back in the middle of the night. But as you can imagine, riding out this storm for somebody so intrinsically tied to New Orleans was particularly difficult for her. And so when the Waterays come back from their evacuation to Houston, they find Cora changed, shocked, and almost catatonic. And meanwhile, there's been a lot of drama in the family. They're angry with one another, Tess and Joe, the husband and wife. You know, each feels that the other abandoned their child. And meanwhile, they've been taking care of Vincent, who's the patriarch of the family, a cabinet maker considered to be one of the best in the South. But he's got Lewy body dementia now, and he's losing his memories at the same time as everyone else has lost their home. And so they come back to their city in shambles, and they themselves are in shambles, and they have to figure out how and if it's possible to put themselves back together again.
So which was the most difficult character for you to write?
Strangely, I think it was Cora, even though she was sort of the center of the emotion of the book for me. I'd say that Cora is sort of a manifestation of the most difficult emotions that I experienced after Katrina. I think I tend to, when I'm writing something hard, I kind of take a complex emotional experience and divide it up amongst a bunch of people. And I think Cora got the worst of it. And so to write her was the hardest emotionally for me, because I had to confront like the deepest parts of my trauma and grief over what happened to the city and the flooding.
And who was the easiest?
Strangely, Vincent.
I loved him.
Oh, thanks.
I loved him.
Vincent just wandered up to me one day. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in a park on a hill looking at somebody chasing their dog. And I just started to hear this old guy talking to me. He was wandering around in Covington amongst a bunch of felled trees. And he was looking for his dog. And then he and I both realized together that the dog died in 1978.
Wow. That's a gift.
Yeah.
You have to use it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Now, this was a difficult novel to write for you, and it took you a long time. You worked on this book for 8 years. So I'm curious to know how it first came to you. Was it an image? Was it a character? Was it the beautiful title? What?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that moment where Vincent arrived to me on the hill was one of the originating moments. But I had actually, even before the storm, had an idea for a book somewhat like this, where I was standing in a ramshackle mansion on St. Charles Avenue. This was probably in, I'd say, June of 2005. My mother is an estate lawyer, and so sometimes we end up in these houses of people who don't really have heirs, and like there are treasures just piled up to the ceiling and there are holes in the ceiling, and the oculus above the stair in this particular house was cracked. And there was a strange watery light falling through the stairwell. And I was just thinking about the accumulation of history in this place and how much is required to maintain it and to hold on to it, because we love it so dearly here. But it's a constant struggle against nature to keep it with us. And so carrying that image through the evacuation from the storm and into the aftermath, I knew that I needed this house full of important artifacts from the history of the family and the history of the city, and a way to write about the city and the losses that it potentially faced through a house like that, through those things, and through the family who understood those things as intimately as the Waterys do.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting after the storm how people would say things don't matter, but they do.
They do.
They really do. And it's almost as if they have a life of their own. Mm-hmm. And you have this wonderful passage describing Tess going through their house at Esplanade and Royal and contemplating the damage wrought by this falling tree. So I wonder if you'd read that passage, because I think a lot of people can identify with it.
Of course. And to give you a little bit of context, Cora, their daughter, is missing. Tess has come home the night before to discover that both of her daughter's beds are empty. And Cora hasn't really left her bed since they discovered her back in New Orleans after the storm. And so to find that neither of them is home as dawn breaks terrifies Tess. And she goes to their real home, hoping that perhaps Cora is there and also fearing what she might find. Tess stood up and went into the house. She paused to lock the vestibule doors, then picked up a lantern and snapped it on, illuminating the blooms of yellow and pink mold on the garlanded ceiling. As she skirted the dangling chandelier, the swollen floorboards moaned beneath her feet. Something somewhere rustled. The hair went up on the back of her neck. Cora? Her voice bounced against the high ceiling of the hall. The rustling stopped with a thud, followed by a strange, hoarse cry. Somewhere the hinges of a door were whining. Cora! Tess got no answer. She ran to the kitchen door and unbolted the padlock. In the gash of warming sky, the tree hung its melancholy head. The leaves had been disturbed again, a space had been cleared, big enough for a body, and a sticky smell like sex and sleep drifted in the air. But the countertops were clear, the cabinets closed. She took a deep breath, and then she heard it again, the rustle, accompanied by a sound like someone fighting for breath. She ran up the front stairs, her heart hammering so hard that she had to wait on the landing for a second while the blood returned to her brain. The rustling was louder here, but the rasping sound had stopped. The latch on Cora's door had not caught, and the breeze that slipped through the hall made the door move gently on its hinges. She pushed it open. The bird came at her in a green flurry, the dark ripping open as lime wings tore through it. A feather touched her cheek, and she heard herself scream, and the bird shrieked back in a voice she recognized as one from the multitude of Quaker parrots that lived in the palm tree. She dropped her hands, and the bird landed in the middle of the floor, then hopped onto a pile of boxes at the end of the hall. It lifted its day-glow wings, squawked. From the doorway, she threw the lantern light around the room. It was empty of any evidence her child had ever lived there. No clothes, no dolls, none of the sentimental treasures she kept arrayed on her mantelpiece, no ribbons or books or trinket boxes, no furniture even for Cora to hide behind. She opened the door to her own room, to the closet, to the bathroom where the tub sat empty, to Dell's room. The hole in the roof had gotten bigger now. Now she could see the sky. She returned to the hallway where the palm-sized stain on the carpet had faded to a dull brown, and the parrot flew to the banister. She opened the door that led outside onto the upper gallery. From the down magnolia, out of the broken staves of wood and loose shingles, midges were rising into the fog of early sun, and she realized that this was all only the beginning. Soon, flowering vines would push their claws into the chimney's mortar, and roaches would crawl up out of the drains. Mice would chew through the cabinets, and the cats who brawled on the back fence at night would stalk them through the limbs of the fallen tree. As the swamp advanced, nutria would amble out of the reeds, and cypress trees would bow their heads and pull up their knees beside the big rococo bookcase. Eventually, the lake, then the river, then the gulf would wash across Joe's mosaic of the sea, and the mangroves would wind their snaking roots through the floors. Eventually, the lichen-covered walls would tremble as the muskrats moved inside them, and the termites would accomplish their slow work of ruin. That would take years, though. It was important to focus on the now. Now, now, now.
I love that so much. I can imagine my own house falling to ruin when I read that.
I can see my own house falling to ruin as we speak.
It's incredible. Now, this is a fiercely moral novel. You write a lot about what we owe to ourselves, to our families, to others, to our city as well. So there are lots of meditations on what it means to try and fail and try again.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really struck me about the storm and its aftermath was that, you know, the city, we felt sort of that we had been abandoned, that the things that we trusted external to ourselves that were supposed to protect us had failed us. Not just the levees, but the government on every level. And then it became a miracle to watch how we helped each other, how it became essential for each individual to help his or her neighbor and to take care of himself or herself. I think that was the thing that I brought home with me, the idea that you are responsible for yourself and for the people around you to take care of them, as hard as it may be and as often as you might fail at it. You have to keep trying.
So what's your Katrina story?
I was here living in my parents' house that summer. I had just gotten home from a couple of years in Europe. And I had made friends with this French girl, Sophie, whose host family had decided to evacuate to one of the hotels downtown. And she calls me up and she says, "Morgan, I don't think this is a good idea. I want to come with you." And I said, "Okay, sure." Sophie lost all command of her English by the third hour on the 12-mile bridge while we watched the water spouts spin up on the lake. And then I think it was maybe 10 days after, when it became just remotely feasible to get back in, my father and I came back down from Nashville, where we had friends who had taken us in, and just surveying the extremely strange geography of, you know, your city, your home, covered in lake mud and patrolled by National Guardsmen, was so incredibly surreal. We went into our house, and I think it wasn't 15 minutes later that we hear shouting from the front hall. There's a man in the front hall who's yelling, you know, "FBI."
Oh, no.
It turned out to be an FBI chaplain who had dated my mother back in high school, who had come to make sure that, you know, we were who we should be in our house. But this idea that a place that is supposed to be, you know, safe and familiar can be turned so incredibly inside out was, yeah, life-changing.
But now you're home for good.
I am, yeah.
In this changed city, here we are. We both are. This is a terrific book, Morgan.
Thank you so much.
Oh, we've been talking with Morgan Babst, whose new novel is The Floating World. You can meet her Tuesday, October 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Atlanta-based novelist David Fulmer has had a long love affair with New Orleans and the Storyville era, and that love is the backbone of his Valentine St. Cyr mystery series. That series began in 2001 with Chasing the Devil's Tale, which won the Seamus Best First Novel Award. Now he's back with the sixth in the series, Eclipse Alley. David Fulmer, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
And I'm happy to be speaking to you again, Susan. It's been too long.
Yes. So what first captivated you about Storyville? That's been your abiding love for all these years.
It has, and I frankly don't know what's not to be captivating about Storyville. And one of the things that I always was puzzled by, that there hadn't been more fiction done about Storyville, but I was perfectly happy to be able to be among the few. It's just the confluence of all these strains. I mean, obviously the sex, the political maneuvering, all the money that was going on, the controlled corruption, that there was music there. It was at the birth of jazz. And all these things together just, to me, created this just amazing stage, this really compelling and riveting stage upon which to place these stories. And so I've never wanted at all for, you know, material from Storyville.
Well, give us a sense of your Creole detective, Valentin St. Cyr. He's a complicated guy.
Well, I hope so. I wanted to be able to create a character that could cross lines. And because it was New Orleans, I gave him this very complex Creole mix of bloods that allowed him to do that. Now, he does have African blood, along with Sicilian blood and some others thrown in there. So he is technically colored, quote unquote, but he appears such that he can cross the color line, and I did that specifically. Some people take him as white, and one of the things that I wanted to put in there, and I got this from looking at my daughter when she was young, most of the time she looks like her mother's family. She turned a certain way, and I could see my family. It's just the difference in the light, and that really struck me, and that's one of the things with Valentin, that he appears differently at different times. He also has, I gave him this pretty complicated and somewhat tragic biography, backstory, that he carries along with him when he gets involved in these cases. And so he has, I think, developed and changed over time, as are the characters closest to him.
Now, the women in this book are so interesting. His wife, Justine, and there's a reporter who's also very much interested in him as well.
Yes, and Susan, I didn't specifically set out to write a quote-unquote woman's book, but that's just the way the characters came to me. And so I wanted, again, to have characters who have, you know, lots of rough edges, and characters who are not afraid to step out and break bounds and be controversial in their own right. And this one, yeah, it's kind of peppered with them.
And sexual politics loom as large as ever in this book.
Yes, it was such an interesting time. And that's the other thing about Storyville, and the other thing about this particular period. The first two decades of the 20th century were nationally such an interesting period of time. There were so many changes going on socially, politically, economically, and Storyville kind of dropped right into that. And so these characters also are affected by that. And when this book takes place, was right on the edge of suffrage. And so there's this sort of liberation movement going on that, you know, as we all know, was a very difficult time. But these characters, these female characters, are influenced by that, and they are products of their times.
And Justine, his wife, is longing for a bit of the action, you could tell.
Yes. Well, again, I wanted her to develop over time. And as the series has gone on, she has changed in some, I hope, interesting ways. But one of them is, starting with the book before this, which is called The Iron Angel, she actually gets involved in his cases because he needs her to, and because he trusts her, and because she has a certain kind of smarts that really work for him as a partner.
Well, real street smarts. And then Rebecca Marcus, who's the society columnist for the paper who wants the true crime beat. And I kept thinking about our society columnists today, thinking, no, I don't think they do that.
Well, it's controversial for Rebecca, but as you know, she also has a pretty interesting biography.
Oh, yeah.
And she has a certain kind of courage that she just throws herself out there. And there's the one instance early in the book where this opportunity opens up for her. And I'm big on that, that these points come when you have a choice to make that is going to determine, you know, what comes next in a major way. And Rebecca gets the opportunity to jump onto this case and get involved in, and she just strikes like a cobra, and then she is a major player throughout.
Now, this is a particularly brutal series of murders that St. Cyr is solving in Eclipse Alley. And there's a theme, too, running through this novel about the lost music of Buddy Bolden.
Yes. Well, Buddy Bolden was one of the main characters in the first book, Chasing the Devil's Tail. And he has appeared throughout in more sort of in a ghostly way. And he and Valentine were childhood friends, as I've written this. And just so we're clear, Valentine is a fictional character. Bolden was a real historical character. But I painted them as childhood friends in the neighborhood around First and Liberty Streets. And Valentine has never been able to shake that other side of him, almost like the duality that Buddy Bolden brought to him, that Valentine was precise and thoughtful and much more mental, whereas Bolden was wild and emotional. And but because they were such good friends when they were young, and because Valentine went through, you know, the tragedy that happened to Bolden, he's never been able to forget about him, and I've never been able to forget about him, and so he keeps appearing in these books.
Well, there is this fascination we have with unheard music. You know, we know it existed, but we may never have heard it.
Yes, and a wax cylinder recording plays a part in the narrative of this book, and a wax cylinder recording of Buddy Bolden's band was lost somewhere, probably in the 60s. It just kind of would surface and became this white whale. So that always fascinated me. And I will tell you that the thought that there still could be something out there somewhere of Bolden's band, it just intrigues me. It's like a barn find or something like that, that somehow it's going to show up. And I know that's sort of a pipe dream, but that was so much a part of the history of jazz, the history of New Orleans music specifically, and it just can't be found anywhere else. And it haunts Valentine, and it kind of haunts me, too.
Well, I think of it as part of the poetic fabric of our city, really. We all latch on to that idea.
Yeah, the sonic texture of New Orleans. And really, Susan, I will tell you that what originally drew me to write the first book was that my fascination with the birth of jazz. I'm really interested in how things are created, what they were at their inception. As they go along, not so much. You know, I tend to lose interest as they get formalized and so forth. But that development, that birth, whatever that big bang was of jazz, you know, just fascinated me. And so that was what really drew me to want to do the first book. And, of course, I wanted Bolden in it. And so then I needed to create someone to be his counterpart, which was Valentine.
Now, not only do you have a new book, but you have a new New Orleans publisher bringing all your St. Cyr series novels back into print. So how did this connection with Crescent City Books come about?
Well, Michael Zell, who you know well, are old buddies going back to the first book and when he was working in bookstores around the city. And it was actually Michael's idea to go to the publisher of Commonwealth Books in Boston, who happens to own Crescent City Books, and present him with this idea that here are these books that are now out of print, and we have an opportunity to start this new imprint about New Orleans. It's a New Orleans-centric imprint. It's either books about New Orleans or with New Orleans authors. And he said, this is sort of a known quantity. It's gotten good reviews. It's got rewards and nominations. And I had spoken to Michael, and I said, yeah, I'm working on this new book. And he said, so we can come out with new editions of the first five and then a brand new one, which is Eclipse Alley, in October. And then I will tell you that we are going to do one more next year, number 7. And I'm thinking that might be it. That 7 seems like a good number.
Lucky number. Well, lucky for readers anyway. So we've been talking with David Fulmer, whose new novel is Eclipse Alley, the 6th in the Valentine St. Cyr series. You can meet him Tuesday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. And again, Wednesday, October 25th at 6 at Crescent City Books for a reading, signing, and writing workshop. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I'm looking forward to seeing you and all my friends in New Orleans on the 24th and 25th.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Morgan Babst, discusses and signs The Floating World Tuesday, October 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Christopher Schaberg signs his new book, Airportness, Wednesday, October 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. One Book, One New Orleans presents How Malcolm Learned to Read, an evening with the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans, Wednesday, October 18th from 6 to 8 at the Mid-City branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Students and instructors from various programs will read original poetry inspired by their study of Counting Descent by Clint Smith. John McGill signs The Incomparable Magazine Street, Thursday, October 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tom Gilbert signs Blue Suede Shoes, The Culture of Elvis, Thursday, October 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. John Paget, author of The Secret of Ventriloquism, and John Pope, author of Getting Off at Elysian Fields, appear in the Dogfish Reading Series Thursday, October 19th at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Errol and Peggy Scott Labor discuss and sign New Orleans, the First 300 Years, Thursday, October 19th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Denise Kiernan discusses and signs The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home, Friday, October 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Library hold their big book sale October 19th through 22nd. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, October 19th through 21st, from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday, October 22nd, from noon to 5. That's at the Pontchartrain Center, 4545 Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. David Cuthbert and Bob Bruce sign Cinderella Battistella, Saturday, October 21st at noon at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library are holding a really, really, really old book sale, Sunday, October 22nd at 1 at the Carriage House behind Ladder Library. There will be a members preview sale, Saturday, October 21st from 3 to 5. Some real treasures could be yours. Today's guest, David Fulmer, discusses and signs his new Valentine St. Cyr mystery, Eclipse Alley, set during the Storyville era, Tuesday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Fulmer also appears Wednesday, October 25th at 6 at Crescent City Books for a signing and writing workshop. Dates to mark on your calendar now. The Louisiana Book Festival takes place Saturday, October 28th on the grounds of the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Check out their website, louisianabookfestival.org, for information about the workshops taught by visiting writers Jocelyn Jackson, Michael Ferris Smith, Beth Ann Fennelly, Kathy Murphy, and Jeff Center. Those are Friday, October 27th. The New Orleans Book Festival takes place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. Coming up, Garden District Bookshop presents novelist Isabella Allende discussing her book In the Midst of Winter with Anne Gislason. That's November 17th at 6 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for information. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II, November 16th through 18th at the museum, with 3 full days of internationally known writers. For more information, go to www.2conference.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.